Hey, welcome along. This is Mark Stein live around the planet. It is 4 o'clock Eastern time in North America. That means it's 5 o'clock in the Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 in Newfoundland, 6 o'clock in Bermuda, and 9 p.m. in London, 10 o'clock in Europe, 11 o'clock Egypt, and midnight in Moscow, and Wednesday morning for all our various listeners in Asia and the Antipodes. And I'm live here to take your questions from Mark Stein Club members wheresoever you may be on the planet today. And we're going to get to that in just a moment. I just want to do a little bit of kind of internal housekeeping first. This is going to be the last of our little get-togethers for a wee while, because after tomorrow's piece is posted, Wednesday, I got to disappear off to some obscure parts to attend to a little bit of an overdue project. I've got to do that in part because of the fallout from my tremendous victory in the CRTV suit against me. You may remember CRTV and Carrie Katz and that misbegotten network sued me for $10 million. They lost on every one of their claims, and the judge instead awarded me $4 million. And then 24 hours later, Carrie Katz called and said he was never going to pay that. And just to emphasize how much he's never going to pay that, he subsequently sued me again for, he took me, I think, I've got to try and remember all this because it gets a bit hard to keep track of. I think there's 4 current cases now. But he sued me again at the AAA American Arbitration Association for a mere $5 million this time. And I was thinking that's pretty good because that's half as much as he sued me for last time. But then he sued me for defamation. That one's in federal court for $15 million. So that's $5 million more than he did last time. And then, of course, he's also suing himself in Clark County Court in Nevada in order to drive CRTV into bankruptcy. And so I've had to be a plaintiff in intervention there. That's a first for me. I've never been a plaintiff in intervention. I've almost got the... If you bear with me a moment, this will be water of a duck's back to you lawyers out there. But so just if you're keeping track on things, I think I've got this right. In the New York, original New York court action... I'm the plaintiff now, and because I'm suing to get the $4 million given to me. In the second arbitration, I'm the defendant because he's resued me for $5 million. In the defamation suit against me, because I called him a scofflaw and a deadbeat on the grounds that he is a scofflaw and a deadbeat, so he sued me for defamation, and I believe, I'm the defendant there, and I'm the I got it wrong again. I'm the plaintiff in the New York suit. I'm the respondent in the new arbitration suit. I'm the defendant in Carrie Katz's defamation federal suit, and I'm the plaintiff in intervention in the self-suing Carrie Katz versus Carrie Katz suit in Nevada. So I think I've got the full set there. I'm a plaintiff, defendant, respondent, and plaintiff in intervention. I'm not yet a counterclaimant, but I probably will be any day now. And if you're having trouble, don't worry if you can't keep track of that. I can't keep track of it either. Anyway, the reason people say, well, what's that got to do with anything? Well, it means that in a few weeks' time, all this flim-flam, these are vexatious litigation intended as a form of extortion upon me. He's an extortionist too. Did I call him that? And so I've got a few weeks over the summer to try and get some things done before I get to attending to these latest things. I ought to say something, by the way. It became clear to me about halfway through the trial that CRTV was losing the suit badly. So I wasn't terribly surprised by Judge Gordon's final award on February the 21st. And, you know, everybody likes $4 million. I suppose I could buy a yacht or whatever and go sailing around and do this show live from the yacht. But I don't actually, generally speaking, I've worked for what I've earned in my life. Cats and CRTV ruined me and they blew through a lot of money. But to be honest, I never wanted Cats's money for myself. I feel dirty just having this creep in my life with his suits every 5 minutes. He filed the one suit, I think, the day after the New York confirmation, and then he sued me again 8 days later, and then another 8 days after that, filed another suit. He's a bum, and I don't want a bum's money for myself. I don't want it for myself. So I made a decision, I guess this would be early February, that I didn't actually want to. Obviously, I've got like seven figures of legal fees and all the rest of it, and I got to pay off the lawyers and that kind of thing. But that once I'd paid off the lawyers and the 76 grand to the American Arbitration Association and so on, I didn't want a dime of this money. I regard a lot of Conservatism Inc. as very suspect and malodorous and a bit of a racket. But I wanted to give this money to what I thought of as the best kind, the best of America. And in particular, I wanted to give the money to Hillsdale College, where I taught. I taught a writing class for some years, and that's where I first met a lot of people you see me on television with now, like Kat Timpf on the Greg Gutfeld Show and various people. And so I wanted to give the money to Hillsdale College and also to Gatestone Institute, which is the premier voice for alerting Americans to what is going on around the rest of the world in terms of Islamic supremacism. Hillsdale is a great bastion of constitutional conservatism, the best kind of constitutional conservatism, with real integrity and honor in how it advances those ideas. And as I said, Gatestone Institute does pretty solid job for the rest of the planet in terms of alerting us to what's going on in Sweden and Germany and places like that. And so I won't be getting a penny for myself. The idea was I wouldn't get a penny for myself. They would get seven-figure sums from Judge Gordon's award. And I assumed this guy was an honorable man and he would pay up. And it looks now as if he's going to determine to drag me on and on into years of legal battles, which will mean that Hillsdale College and the Gatestone Institute may well get substantially reduced sums, because that's how much of a dishonorable bum Katz is. But I don't want any of his filthy money. And I'm happy to, as I said, give these sums to Hillsdale and to Gatestone. I just wish he'd do the decent thing, write the check, screw off out of my life, bugger off, get on with his crappy little network and put an end to this thing. But he's not a big enough man to do that. And so he's just dragging this out. And when, if ever, and I will make sure that Hillsdale does get that money and that Gatestone does get that money. But it does mean that I have to get on over the next couple of weeks and take this advantage of a little bit of a window before all these his three other stupid suits against me start cranking up. And I have to get on with those. So this is going to be, I'll tidy that up and put it all in a bit of a clearer form. So this will be one of our last little get-togethers for a while. I will say this too, that if you subscribe to the Mark Stein Club, for the time I'm away, we will add that and extend that to your 12-month membership. We want you to get a full 12 months. We'll shift the expiry date to take account of this little block of time. But I regret that, but it's what you have to do. I've got to earn a big chunk of money just to deal with another seven figures in legal fees that this bum will make me spend on his three stupid suits, all of which he's going to lose because he's a loser when he gets into court. But unfortunately, he's a deep-pocketed loser, so he can afford to just jerk you around, because that's one of the bizarre features of the American system, that an obvious vexatious litigant with meritless legislation can torment his victims for as long as he wants. But let's put that bum aside and get on with your questions. And I'm happy to take questions on that if you've got any that you want to throw my way. The first question that comes in actually is about the Irish border. If you think the Irish question is intractable, try doing business with Carrie Katz. I tell you, I would much rather be trying to figure out loyalist versus Republican and Catholic versus Protestant than getting into any business with CRTV. And this is all to do with Brexit. where people, the funny thing about Brexit, because on the morning after Brexit, or actually the morning of Brexit, because the result didn't come through until I think 4:42 in the morning or something, and I'd gone to bed early in London because I'd seen Nigel Farage on TV saying that he thought he'd come up a bit short and Brexit was lost. So I thought, I'm not watching the BBC crowing for hours on end. So I turned in, had an early night, woke up early and switched on the TV just as an ashen-faced David Dimbleby was announcing that the United Kingdom had voted to leave the European Union. And I was flying out of Heathrow to Dublin that morning, and at Heathrow there were all these announcements. It was like there was a kind of last train from Berlin mood about it, and there was a voice over the tannoy going, notwithstanding the vote to leave the European Union, flights from Heathrow will be departing as usual this morning. And so we got on the little shuttle to Dublin and I sat next to a delightful young Colleen, and we were quaffing champagne, as one does on that rather agreeable flight, all the way to Dublin. And at Dublin, the big news was what was going to happen to the border between north and south, because it's not really a border, and it hasn't been ever since it was drawn in 1922 with the creation of the Irish Free State. And I drove across it with my daughter a couple of years ago, and she's used to the US-Canadian border. I said, oh, stand by. We're coming from the north. And I said, oh, stand by. We're coming up to the border. And she thought she'd have to fish out her passport or whatever, but we just went whoosh through the border, and the blue highway signs changed to green, and the instead of miles, it was in kilometres, the speed, and they have some stupid Euro name for it now, because instead, I think on the north side of the border, it's the M1, M for motorway, and then when you get south of the border, It's E for something, because it's some Euro route. They pretend you can drive to Dubrovnik or whatever on it. If you do, you'll get very wet because you'll just be driving straight off the end of the island. Anyway, it's become an issue, that open border, because the EU is trying to make it a thing, and an exploitative government in Dublin is trying to make it a thing too, so that it's become an issue. And Roy Blair, it's all about whether you have a soft border or a hard border. And the EU says there can't be a soft border unless there's a hard border. That was the other thing that was interesting on the news bulletins that day, on the Irish news bulletins. There were these figures from RTE standing there saying, this is now the border, the new frontier between Britain and Europe. And of course, it's not that. It's not that. And the fact that it has got this far reflects very badly on Theresa May's stewardship of negotiations. What's going on there is that the EU is in effect trying to force Northern Ireland out of the United Kingdom and saying you can only have a soft border between North and South in Ireland if there is a hard border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom, which is preposterous. And Roy Blair says, yet who do the Southern Irish politicians blame? You guessed it, the bigoted unionists and the horrible English. They know, of course, that there is no reasoning with their masters in Brussels, so they just roast the old chestnuts. Isn't it an irony that both the Irish and the Scottish nationalists, despite their fixation with independence, see no contradiction in submitting to the tyranny of imperial Europe? That's actually a very good point, Roy. I think what happened, as I look back on it, John O'Sullivan actually wrote a fine piece on this for National Review a couple of weeks ago, that if you look at what happened with that abortion vote in Ireland, that in effect it marks the end of the Catholic nationalist Irish nation state. And the reduction of basically of De Valera's hyper-Catholic, irredentist Irish nationalism, and the great shrug of acceptance that modern Ireland is now no more than just an EU satrap, no different in its dispositions from any of the other EU satraps. And it's interesting to me because that in itself, he was a very powerful figure, and he succeeded in imposing that on part of Ireland. But there was an older Ireland before that that John O'Sullivan writes about, which was in effect a West Britain, and in which Oscar Wilde and Bernard Shaw, Sheridan, Parnell, Burke, all moved easily between Dublin and London as if they were one society. The idea of imprisoning Ireland, walled off from the rest of the British Isles, if you'll forgive the expression, and as a kind of isolated little blip of the Euro Federation would be something unprecedented in Irish history. And actually, I don't think the Irish would like it terribly much. But we will see. Theresa May has bungled Brexit, as she bungles most things, and it's not going to go well for her until her best position was that she'd rather have no deal than a bad deal. She doesn't say that anymore. And it looks like a bad deal is the only one that will be on the table. She's bungled it, and I regret that immensely. David Hagen writes, Mark, could you address... Tom Bruck writes, I'll get to... No, wait a minute, I mentioned David Hagen. Mark, could you address the Supreme Court of Canada's decision on Trinity Western University? It is such a gobsmacking, moronic decision that it puts the whole justice system in disrepute. If the courts can't be counted on to make fair and informed decisions, what does that leave? For the benefit of non-Canadians, this was a 7-2 decision by the Supreme Court of Canada. Six of those judges, by the way, were appointed by a Conservative government. So you can't say that it is the fact that they're all blazing liberals or anything like that. Trinity Western is a Christian university that requires you to subscribe to their university charter, which is that if you attend the school, you must be chaste unto marriage. And so that means that there's no monkeying around. And the LGBT QWERTY community has complained that that discriminates against them because it basically means you can't have any gay sex in the joint. That's the argument. And as a result, law societies have decided that they're not going to accept Trinity Western law graduates because apparently if you take a law degree without shagging like minxes, you're not a properly qualified law graduate to be a student or a solicitor or a barrister. And the Supreme Court of Canada has upheld that it's right to do that in order to protect the safety of the LGBT QWERTY community who might feel traumatized at having chaste Christians practicing law around them. It's an absurd decision, but it confirms a point I made at the time Anthony Kennedy did his big gay marriage decision, which, again, you can make arguments about same-sex. In a way, to go back to the Irish, I prefer the way they do it there. When they change, the people change. So the people voted to say, we don't care about abortion anymore. Sure, faith and begara, be aborted in whatever trimester tickles your fancy. And sure, we like the gay man. We used to think they were the godless sodomites who are going to burn in hell. But now we're all cool with them and we have all like the pink triangles and the rainbow flags everywhere. Sure, and we used to have 40 shades of green and now we've got 40 shades on the rainbow flag. If you change, you change. And you vote to change. In America, Anthony Kennedy tortures the plain language of the Constitution to discover that Madison and Jefferson had cannily foreseen the need for gay marriage a couple of centuries back. And so when he discerns, he puts on his gaydar and he discerns screaming gayness emanating from the US Constitution. I prefer the way the Irish do it, if we have to have it one way or the other. But it makes a point, both south of the border and north of the border. And if you notice, I'm saying that phrase a lot. This isn't about Ireland this time, it's about North America. So south of the 49th parallel, you got Anthony Kennedy torturing the US Constitution into finding a pretext for gay marriage. North of the border, you've got this 7-2 decision against Trinity Western. It makes a point I make in the introduction to my book, The Undocumented Mark Stein, that we often say politics is downstream from culture. Law is downstream from culture. Law is downstream from culture. Anthony Kennedy is getting with the beat. And whatever he thought of gay marriage, it's like 30 years since the Supreme Court of the United States declared there was no constitutional right to sodomy. Then nothing changed. Nothing changed in the law. All that changed was the broader disposition outside the courthouse. And so the judges get with the beat. And that has happened in Washington, as it's happened in Ottawa. And in that sense, rights and politics and law are mere fashion. And the problem for Trinity Western is that chaste Christians are out of fashion. It's no more than that. Nobody really pretends. I mean, the legal arguments are so tortured. Nobody really pretends that it's more than that, except that this class of people, the LGBT QWERTY community, is a protected class, and this class of person, the chaste Christians, are not a protected class. That's all it is. Tom Bruck writes, "Hey Mark, a question for the planet-wide discussion today. How much of a role did technology, like the 24-hour news cycle on cable TV and the internet, contribute to the politicization of literally everything? I would not have thought that the emergent property of technology would be tribalism." That's actually a good way to look at what happened. I was saying that politics and law are downstream of culture, but culture is a funny thing these days, particularly in popular culture. We don't really have popular culture anymore. We just really have mutually jostling outposts of unpopular popular culture. If you compare the audience, say, for The Tonight Show, whoever hosts that now, I don't know, I can never remember, but whoever hosts The Tonight Show now with what Jay Leno's audience was 25 years ago, and more particularly with what Johnny Carson's was 50 years ago, or with what Jack Parr and Steve Allen were 55 and 60 years ago. What's happened is that there's no mass middlebrow culture in that sense anymore. Things that the generality of people agree on. So that it actually makes sense. If you look at the way these late night shows go, where they're now being hyper-partisan, that's actually a good business decision in a strange way. I mean, it's a tragic one, but in actual fact, deciding to write off the 50% of the country who voted for Donald Trump and just trying to hyper-intensify a liberal sliver actually makes sense from a business point of view, because everything is niche now. Everything is niche. And so there's no point in trying to make something for everyone. And I think also things like Twitter have enabled, you know, the worst part of, to go back to the heyday of the Tonight Show, the worst part of that in some ways, or the worst part of any of those kind of shows, was when the pop star or the movie actor would be invited to discourse on current events. People thought it was silly. People, if you remember when Vanessa Redgrave at the Oscars in whatever it was, 1977, did some pro-Palestinian thing. At that point, people, it was weird. It was so weird. It was so bizarre. it was freakish. Now the pop stars are doing that all the time. John Legend is just writing these four-letter epithets against Trump all day long. And he couldn't do that if we were dealing in the days of big popular culture, in going back to, you know, Glenn Miller or Bing Crosby, because the point about being Bing or the point about being Glenn Miller is that everybody loved you. You wanted to have tens of millions of people who loved you. And you don't get that now. Everything's niche. And so there's a lot of, in that sense, technology has fragmented us. They used to talk about the global village. And I said 20 years ago, it's not going to be a global village. It's going to be like a particularly unpleasant housing project with various feuding, dysfunctional families on every floor. And I think that's the way it's turned out. I don't know how you undo that. But I think the future of the internet is actually going to be far more controlled. You already see it with Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and the like. And that in some ways the hyper-tribalism will end in part because a malign combination of the state and this social media cartel are making the internet a lot less interesting than it used to be. Chris Hall writes, although there seems to be widespread discomfort in Europe about unregulated immigration, aka invasion from the Middle East, there's still not a lot of truly effective opposition to it outside of a few countries. The old Warsaw Pact seems to include stalwart opponents to the flood, possibly because they see the commissars of Strasbourg and Brussels to be depressingly like the old ones they had to deal with domestically. Do you see the new strange bedfellows government in Italy as a possible model for finally pushing the European uniparties to confront reality? Could it work in other countries? It's a bit like the Churchill-Stalin alliance, and it's likely not going to be stable in the long run. But maybe they could tackle the big problems now and figure out the small stuff later. I think that's a good way to look at it, actually. Not the Churchill-Stalin thing. But to put it in domestic terms, when Churchill formed his war cabinet in the spring of 1940, he invited Labour and Liberal members to join it because he felt that the nation is at war and that's something that the whole nation has to resist. In other words, existential crises put an end to the old left-right continuum. And I think if you recognize that the transformative immigration that has gone on in Europe in recent decades is an existential crisis, then clearly voting for a party because it's offering a 4% cut on marginal tax rates, or likewise for the left-wing party because it's offering to start a new social welfare program, that's not actually what is at issue anymore. It's not enough. And people, the mainstream parties, keep wanting to go back to that. And that's actually what happened in the Italian election, that it was only the extreme right, so-called, and the extreme left, so-called, that were actually willing to talk about the principal issue of concern to the electorate. That's also true in in Brexit, despite the fact that there was a significant block of Conservative members of Parliament who were opposed to the European Union's increasing centralisation, it was not possible to get serious action from the leaders of the Tory party to address that question. So you had a ridiculous situation where in some of these countries, for example, in almost all these countries, there is a majority that is opposed to continuing mass immigration. Yet all the mainstream parties say nothing can be done. You can't have that without having a crisis of the state. Because a democracy assumes that the parties that put themselves up for election will address the issues that are paramount in the electors' minds. Now, and bear in mind that in most European countries, you don't have this frozen system as in the United States, where it's all but impossible to launch a new political party. So I think what's happening in Italy, where effectively they've said, whether you're left-wing or right-wing, we happen to think that this immigration thing is the biggest single issue. And as none of the mainstream parties will deal with it, we now have this pantomime horse coalition between extreme left and extreme right. It might actually, if it addresses that issue, the other stuff can wait. Gary Palman writes, the Q&A is a bit too early for us Tokyoites, but I thought I'd try posting a question here in advance. I wonder if you had seen the mega hit Hamilton. The show characterises Alexander Hamilton, who was three quarters British, one quarter French, born and raised in British colonies and presumably steeped in British thinking and tradition, the Magna Carta and all that, as an immigrant to New York, which was at the time another British colony. It then argues how vital immigrants were to the founding of the US, aside from the fact that someone from Georgia, say, would have been equally an immigrant in New York at that time. The show seems caught up in the whiteness of the founding fathers versus the Caribbean Hamilton rather than their common British cultural heritage. It's a tiresome argument. Whites colonised Latin America as well, and look at the mess they made there. But what's disturbing is that the show is being presented in schools as a way to make history more relevant and fun. Any thoughts on all this? Gary, that's a very good point. The premise of Hamilton is dishonest. The premise that America is a nation of immigrants is dishonest. And as you say, the distinction between Latinos and the whiteness of North America is also dishonest. Short history, the last half millennium. The northern half of the Americas was colonized by Anglo-Celts. The southern half of the Americas was colonized by Spanish and Portuguese. So in the northern half, you have centuries of continuous, peaceful, constitutional evolution and economic progress. In the southern half, you have El Presidente for life and coups and police chiefs with reflector shades and bodies being thrown out of Argentine Air Force planes over the Atlantic as dissidents are disappeared. That's it. That's the short history of the Americas over the last half millennium. But they try to pretend that somehow the that's the relevance of the whiteness. The whiteness tells you nothing. It's the variance of white in the northern half, in North America, as versus the whites in South America, that determined the political and socio-economic cultures of each part of the Americas. Now, you're right to point out that Hamilton isn't an immigrant. It's not a nation of immigrants. Basically, the settlement of North America, British North America, as was then, it was internal movement within His Majesty's dominions. You moved from one part of the British Empire to another part of the British Empire. That's not immigration. You had the same. You were a British subject in Kingston-on-Thames. You were a British subject in Kingston, Jamaica, and you were a British subject in Kingston, Ontario. There's absolutely no distinction made and in law at all, and nor in reality. People actually didn't think of themselves as anything other than what they were, the inheritors, as you put it, of the tradition of Magna Carta and all that. Colin Powell's autobiography is very interesting on that point, because Colin Powell's parents are from Jamaica, and he actually speaks very warmly of how he, one reason he thinks that Caribbean blacks do not have the bitterness and the residue of racism and whatever that exists in the American South is because under English law, British subjects are British subjects. That's it. There's no legal difference between them. There may be social differences. You might be frowned on if you're a white aide to the governor of St. Kitts, and you start dating one of the black village girls or whatever, there might be some social tensions there. But as a legal matter, there's no difference in status. So the basis of the musical Hamilton is fundamentally dishonest. The other thing about this Nation of Immigrants thing that is completely absurd, actually, that isn't true. There was a survey done about 25 years ago that said if they'd closed the borders on July the 4th, 1776, about half the people in the United States as late as the early 1990s were descendants of people who were here before 1776. The American Republic was set up, as the rebel colonists put it, for us and our posterity. Our posterity, it's not to be confused with posterior, that's your butt, that's what you're sitting on. Our posterity means our descendants. They did not see themselves as a nation of immigrants. They saw themselves as British subjects raised with English ideas of liberty, who had a dispute with a tyrannical king, threw off that king, but did not throw off the parts of their inheritance that they valued. And they were building a republic based on what they saw as English ideas of liberty in the 13 colonies. The idea that there's 7 billion people on the planet and they're all just Americans in waiting would have struck these guys as completely preposterous. It's just more that it's basically he's been culturally appropriated, poor old Hamilton, to serve the purposes of modishness. Trudeau's highbrow eyebrow writes, is it finally farewell time for Angela Merkel? She may be gone this week. And the only reason I balk at making a firm prediction of that is that she's been in that spot before, and she's always managed to wiggle out at the last moment, in part because there's no one else. Whatever it is, the Hilaire-Belloc line, always keep a hold of nurse for fear of finding something worse. And Angela Merkel has been the nurse, and a lot of Germans are worried that something worse is waiting after her. And then she blew that because she made everything worse. She made crime worse. I was reading the case of this teenage girl found murdered round the back of somewhere near, walking home from the station, between the railway station and her home. And it was interesting to me that, because I went all over Europe a couple of summers ago. And the thought occurred to me first, I think it was in Kempele in Finland, and then again in a small town in central Sweden. They use public transport a lot more than in a way that perhaps Americans don't quite grasp on the continent. People go to work and come home by train. People go to school, come home by train. And the number of sexual assaults that took place on roads called Railway Road or Station Street actually was quite striking to me. It's a thing. It's a trend. You catch your regular train home, but the summer is dying and there's a touch of autumn in the air and it gets dark a little earlier. And in that crepuscular twilight on the short quarter mile home from the station, there appears to be a shadow just round the corner. And you round the corner and you get raped by one of the young men that Angela Merkel brought into your country. It's a thing. It's a trend. Attacks on trains, attacks going to the station, attacks walking back from the station. It's a thing. And it's a thing because Angela Merkel made it a thing. And if she doesn't survive that gross stupidity, it will be well-deserved. Mark writes, Judith Kempen, Grandma Judy, she signs herself. Mark says, Grandma Judy, why aren't there more conservative news outlets and newspapers? There surely must be a few folks with enough resources to start one or buy an outlet or newspaper. What is the reason for this, do you think? I'm not sure it's worth buying a newspaper these days. I get asked every so often to go in on buying a newspaper or buying an old newspaper I used to work for. A lot of these brands aren't worth anything anymore. And I think it's interesting to me that's actually not an effect. That's not necessarily an effective way of reaching people. Where their ideas are formed now. I was in Toronto a couple of days ago and I flew back and I'm sitting on the plane next to some sort of young Twinkie snowflake type of guy. And he got out his, tablet, that's what he called. And he was watching one of these shows that, what was I saying, His Majesty's Dominions? They got a hammerlock. Basically, late-night American television has been conscripted within Her Majesty's Dominions. Everybody on there now. It's like, who's the Canadian? Samantha Bee? And from the UK, it's John Oliver and James Corden. South Africa, Trevor Noah. Is there anyone on late night American TV who isn't from the British Commonwealth? It's pathetic. When are you Americans going to man up and go take a how to host a late night television show course and take back your TV? These guys have reversed the Declaration. What was the point of the Declaration of Independence? Just so you can sit around watching snarky Brit TV hosts before you turn in for the night. So this little Twinkie snowflake guy, very fetching young man, and he opens his tablet and he's watching, what's the guy called? Is it John Oliver? I can't hear what the guy is saying, but he's like waving his arms around and he's showing clips of Sean Hannity and Judge Jeanine and then having a big old laugh about them. And I think actually that's the space in which So in other words, the left's ideas against Trump are not formed by reading the New York Times or the Boston Globe or the Chicago Tribune. Those are irrelevant. Then certainly not formed by watching whoever's playing Dan Rather and Walter Cronkite this week on the evening news at 6:30. A lot of these, what's happened is essentially that apolitical people have become leftists because the culture snarks about the right. So that it, instead of buying a newspaper, it would actually make far more sense for the Koch brothers or whoever the big or the Mercers or any of these people, instead of funding Ted Cruz's Senate campaign or presidential campaign or whatever, it would make much more sense for some of these people to actually get together and buy a network, buy NBC, or buy a movie studio. So buying the Boston, because these papers are worthless. The Miami Herald was up for sale a few years ago, and they decided the waterfront property was worth a couple of million, but the newspaper actually isn't worth anything. I mean, these people have destroyed their brand. So unless you've got waterfront property like the Miami Herald, there's no point buying these things. The action, it's that culture, it's that politics is downstream of culture. And when the culture is where it is than buying the Boston Globe and butching up its op-ed page isn't going to do it. David Kelly Wood writes, Mark, there are a few countries which seem unwilling to jump into the communal handbasket to oblivion in Europe, led by Poland and Hungary and a few others. And recently we've seen encouraging developments in Austria and Italy. Are you at all optimistic that we'll see a snowball effect? And have you noticed whether the Trump administration has been supportive of their efforts to any tangible extent? You've been talking about the likely need for the US to realign alliances for some time. I would appreciate hearing your thoughts. Well, Charles Moore, my old boss, actually made an interesting point about this. I'm an imperialist. I think the British Empire was a great civilizing force in the world. It's the reason why India functions, for example, in a way that large parts of the Middle East do not. But there is a problem, and that is a problem that when you have a crisis of legitimacy in an empire, there isn't really a good answer to it, because in the end it's an empire, so it lacks I don't want to be too pro-British or anything here. Austro-Hungarian Empire, I thought that was a great force, actually, for good in Europe. And that what succeeded it in Europe made things worse, made things unstable, and that in part led to the horrors of the Second World War. And certainly, I think if you talk to a lot of Middle European Jews, they felt better off as integrated, assimilated subjects of Franz Josef's multicultural empire than they did as the beleaguered minority in the ethnic nation states that succeeded it. But there's a point at which when people protest an empire, the empire doesn't really have a good response to that. And if you take the view that the European Union is an empire, and in the sense it is, in that it has a huge democratic deficit, then different things bobble up. So, for example, you have Brexit. You have the fact that the Eastern Europeans, the Poles and Hungarians, reject the cozy consensus of the core founders of the empire, which is basically France, Germany, Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg. Then you have Austria voting for populist parties. You have what's happened in Italy. These things aren't necessarily related, but they become a crisis of legitimacy for the empire. And I think when that you can make the same point with the British Empire, that there's not, for example, the Boer republics, Irish nationalism, a little bit of restiveness from otherwise countries that are otherwise very pro the mother country, such as Canada, Indian nationalism, that these things don't really have a lot in common with each other, except insofar as they're all ganging up on the same central force. And I think that's similar to what is actually happening in the EU at the moment. Kevin Clark writes, would you comment on the Inspector General's report? The whole Hillary email investigation seems to me like a real-life Emperor's New Clothes. We've known for a couple of years now that she did everything she was accused of, and virtually everything she offered in her defense was a lie, yet there were no consequences. Why didn't they just say they weren't going to investigate? Because even if she did everything alleged, it was no problem. Well, they arranged a sham investigation. That's what's clear. That basically they're just going through the motions. There's a fantastic bit. So I've got a bit of tickle in the throat today. It's every time I hear the Inspector General and that kind of thing. I'll tell you why. It's because he's a lawyer. Inspector General is a fancy word for lawyer. This guy is a former deputy U.S. attorney in the district of whatever. And he's written a legal report. And legal reports are always disappointing because they're written by lawyers as opposed to great storytellers. And that's why I was delighted with Judge Gordon's decision in my own case, because she wrote a fantastic narrative. You can read it and figure out what's going on and all the rest of it. It's actually brilliantly written in that respect. The Inspector General's is much more like a conventional lawyer's report. So you have to read it, bearing in mind it's written in legalese, and then you have to imagine if you were doing it in dinner theatre and you were to put a human reaction to what he's disclosing in there. And there's a little passage in there where two of the Hillary investigators are joking about the fact that someone who worked on Hillary's server and her laptop and I think a fax machine as well up at Chappaqua is basically nakedly lying to them. And these guys don't care because they know it's a joke investigation. And they're all joking about how this guy's doing, I think they call it a 1001, which is the relevant legal provision that says you're not allowed to lie to the FBI. So in other words, they're joking because this guy's doing what Flynn and Papadopoulos are facing jail time for. But they know he's never going to be dragged into court, never mind dragged into jail, because the operation's a joke. And this boring lawyer guy, the Inspector General, just lays it out in sort of boring lawyerese. And you've got to impose the human reaction on that. But it's a disgrace, and it's a disgrace because they started from the proposition that Hillary was going to win the election, and that therefore there was nothing in it for them in conducting a real investigation. It's disgraceful. I don't know where it goes. You know, I understand that this is the way it is now. We have these ponderous, slow investigations. Peter Strzok, and I believe most of these other five awful people, are still employed at taxpayers' expense. And Christopher Wray's promised to hire a consultant to set up a committee, to file a report, to make recommendations, and in 30 years, someone will do something to implement it. I think the FBI, actually, I think for a start, the FBI should have certain counterintelligence functions taken away from it. No reason for them to have it. They should be just like a domestic policing agency. And I think this demonstrates that, in fact, they've abused those powers. They've abused FISA warrants. They've abused all kinds of things. I think at the very least, that should be taken away from them. But whether anybody does anything, I do not know. Joseph Huber writes, "Hi, Mark. Watching the American liberal media push the families being separated narrative immediately following the destruction of their obstruction narratives by the Inspector General's report has been quite amusing. I see the desperation dripping from their keyboards as a good sign. They're no longer capable of being intelligently deceptive. They have instead turned the entire media into some sort of HuffPost blog. And the American people are seeing it for what it is. My question is, do you think we'll ever see a return to true journalism in the age of the internet?" I don't think so now, because I don't think there's any... there is to a certain extent, in that suddenly everyone's talking about these children. But most of the children who cross... What we have at the border is human trafficking. And human trafficking is a bad thing. And you want to disincentivize human trafficking. And so when people are being, and again, I'll underline the point I made on Tucker's show, which is last night, which I think is absolutely central to this. We've been told that this is a country on orange alert, which is why it's crap to travel around this country. It's miserable. It's a big stinkeroo. I don't know how... And if you think it'll be confined to the airports, no. It'll come to the train stations, and it'll come to the shopping malls, and it'll come to the interstate ramps. Everything's slower. Shuffle, shuffle. Have you ever been at O'Hare in Chicago at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon? D.C., Washington National, Reagan National, Washington, whatever the hell it's called, 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. Everyone shuffling, shuffling, shoeless. The great shoeless shuffle, because we're on orange alert. So if you want to go and visit your grandma in Cleveland, security checks have to be imposed on you. But if you have no grandma in Cleveland, if you're just one of the 6 2/3 billion people out there on the rest of the planet, come on down. The brilliant explanation by Secretary Nielsen that they, so when there is no evidence of a familial relationship, you know, here's Fred Smith and here's my daughter Doris Smith, and she's got a birth certificate saying that Doris Smith's father is Fred Smith. That's all well and good. These people who come across the border, when they can't prove the familial relationship, and when, and this is the important thing, when border agents have reason to suspect they do not, from their behavior, have a familial relationship, then they're separated. I made a simple point about an experience I had with my daughter when some twerp from officious twerp from the Immigration Service was threatening to deport her, and then saying, "Well, and that'd show you, wouldn't it? Because then she'd be back in Canada, and you'd be stuck here." I said, "No, I wouldn't." I said to the guy at one point in the conversation, I said, "Bring me a pair of scissors, and I'll cut up my green card now, because my interest in living in the country ends if the price of that is to be separated from my child." And so, if we're told these sob sister stories by the morons of the American media, oh, they're being ripped from their mother's arms. No, they're not. Why doesn't the mother just say, "Oh, if you're going to rip the baby from my arms, we'll both go back across to the southern shore of the Rio Grande, because my baby's the most important thing. I don't even like my kids most of the time, but I wouldn't have them ripped from my bosom. I'm enough of a father. I'm a lousy father, and they're lousy kids. But I'm enough of a father to say, if you want to rip my daughter from my bosom, forget it. I'm done. I'm out of here. Hasta la vista." But apparently these heartwarming scenes, oh my God, being ripped from... No, you can get, you and your kid can go and live in Mexico. You can go and live in any other country with your kid. But the framing of the issue, the sort of mawkish sob sister drivel, does show that the media are still capable of presenting these stories and framing these stories in these obnoxious ways. Holly writes, "Mark, do you think that CRTV launched your show in good faith and then changed their minds, or do you think they set you up for failure from the beginning? If the former, do you think your support for Donald Trump was the catalyst or some other factor?" Basically, CRTV was very anti-Trump when it started. They were, someone said to me that they were basically the intended to be the media wing of the Ted Cruz campaign. I remember Carrie Katz sitting across the table and saying he was with Ted Cruz. He was all for Cruz. And you know, I got nothing against Ted Cruz, but I didn't think he could win. And it was perfectly obvious to me that Trump was going to win the nomination. As I've said, it's 3 years this week since he came down the Trump Tower escalator. And that's June. I think in September, I said on the Alan Combs radio show that Trump would win the nomination. And I thought he could win the presidency. It just seemed obvious to me that... for the same reasons we've talked about in Europe, is that the mainstream candidates weren't talking about what the electorate wanted to talk about. The most senior host at CRTV was fiercely anti-Trump until 6 weeks or so before the election. There were other never-Trumpers there. There's people who are still never-Trumpers there, and that's fine. But you can't build a network with a great monolithic opinion. You know, and I don't think they'd, I think by the time the show launched, it wasn't in good faith. It wasn't in good faith at all. And I don't want to rehearse any of those old grievances because it all come out. But the, in Discovery, the emails that they sent back and forth and all the rest of it made very clear that, and I'm not saying telling tales out of school because, some of this stuff is out there in the court record in New York and other places, and available for anyone who's that fascinated by it to see it. But I don't think they did launch it in good faith, and I regard Carrie Katz personally as a serial liar. One of the problems, of course, is that he tells different lies to people, and then he's in that old Hollywood position of which lie did I tell, and keeping all the lies aligned becomes the problem. Benjamin Carr writes, "Hey, Mark, on the issue of U.S. demography, it seems that many deep blue states like California and New York seem ripe for massive emigration. How likely do you think it is that mass migration from deep blue states like California may flip the electoral map in favor of the Democrats in the not-so-far future? Your home state of New Hampshire was once a red state till wealthy retirees from Massachusetts and Connecticut moved in for the lighter taxes and flipped New Hampshire blue." Well, the fate of New Hampshire doesn't really matter in the scheme of things, although you may recall that it provided George W. Bush with his margin of victory in the 2000 election. Basically, Karl Rove plotted out what became the Republican strategy for a generation. You win that big L-shaped, where you run down the spine of the Rockies and then do go through the South out to the Atlantic Ocean. You got a big L shape, and then you had a sort of little dotted L in the shape of New Hampshire that provided the margin of victory for George W. Bush in 2000. And over the next few cycles, that L got nibbled away because they talk about these purple states. What they mean by purple states is they mean formerly red states that are trending blue. There weren't any blue states that were trending red. You could, except maybe West Virginia. But basically, a purple state is a formerly red state that's now trending blue. And you can see that in California, where you had like little bastions of conservatism, like Orange County, which used to be red. Orange used to be red, and then now it's purpling. And the question is, what do you do to reverse that? That L strategy, the Karl Rove thing, anyone trying the L strategy for Jeb, Ted Cruz, Marco, it wouldn't have worked in 2016. That's done. That's dead. And the interesting question is, if you look at how California's lost, if you look at how New York is lost, if you look at the state, the huge states that are big blue states and that the Democrats start with, and a Republican can't afford to make a, can't afford to, his margin of error is much tinier than a Democrat's, because demography has turned all these once competitive states solidly blue. What's the next one to fall, absent any changes? Texas. And there goes any chance of electing Republicans again. And this is why demography is always interesting to me. And I find it's, when I talk demography in Europe, I'm talking in big picture terms. I'm talking about towns like major European cities like Brussels that are where there are now more, if you take Antwerp, for example, there are now more Muslims in the school district than there are Catholics. Now, my mum, who's a Catholic from Flanders, my mum would have been astonished if you'd ever told her that. She would think she was living in some science fiction alternative reality thing. So I talk about it in big picture terms there. Here, demography is really a professional thing. People can always tell you, oh, well, you know, the soccer moms in the third district in Ohio are blah, 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 blah. They never think about the big picture transformative demography that has gone on in California and New York. Where do... And liberals are dishonest about this. They pack up and they move when things become, and as you say, they move somewhere and then they forget the reasons they left the place they moved from. But as I said, until Trump came along and sort of bust up some of these categories and won Pennsylvania and won Michigan and places, we were faced away with that crumbling Karl Rove Republican L from the turn of the century. And there is something real at stake here. I listened to all the commentary on Laura Bush's heartwarming pitch. And it's fine. You know, no one's got anything against individual Hispanics or... And we would all like it if all the happy talk was real. But the fact is that demographic changes, sudden mass transformative demographic convulsions operate against the interests of conservatism and the Republican Party. And California's gone, New York's gone. You go back to 1984 when Reagan won New York and Reagan won California. Who are you going to find? What Republican is ever going to win those states again? When? And what happens if Texas goes? What happens if Texas goes? The Republican elite may work for the big donors and the cheap labor lobby, but the Republican base doesn't. And the Republican base was right to demand something other than that, something different than that. And until the contradiction between the donor class, a corrupt donor class, I would call it, and the base is resolved in favor of the base, the Republican Party will continue to cede ground. You see it already. Trump was basically elected because of the consequences of mass immigration. Paul Ryan is determined to prevent any meaningful action on that. Stephen Payne, right, here's our last question. What a chipper one to end the day with. What do you think, Mark? Bang or whimper? It's interesting. Everyone has been predicting, ever since I wrote 2006, America Alone, Ralph Peters said, my gloomy predictions for the Islamization of Europe. And he said, don't forget, he says, don't worry about that. The Europeans are the bloodiest, most murderous, fascistic thugs on the planet. They're going to rise up and do what they always do, and the US fleet is going to be having to evacuate Muslim refugees off the coast of Normandy before all these fascistic French and Germans and Spaniards hack them to death and all this. So that was his view of the happy ending, you know. The glass is 1/20 full. Don't worry about it. And the strong man on a horse scenario is the one they always like. The trouble with the aging demographics thing is most of the strong men can't get up on the horse anymore because they're like the incipient. They're all the age of Monsieur Le Pen, who's, what is he now, 88? Can he still get up on a horse? I don't know. The point here is that the longer you leave it, the longer you leave it, the more likely the whimper scenario where people just, you know, agree to, you're like 63, yeah, you got no kids, the missus has divorced you, everything's turning Muslim, you have to walk a bit further to find a pub that serves alcohol now. But do you really want to, like, join a revolution at that age? I don't know. The longer it goes on, the more the whimper scenario has a whiff of inevitability about it. And Ralph Peters, European-wide conflagration seems less and less likely. I would like something that is neither a bang nor a whimper, but is simply like a robust defense and assertion of civilizational survival instincts. But whether we will get that, I do not know. We have had a grand old time on this Clubland Q&A. If you would like to join us, all you got to do is join the Mark Stein Club, and you sign up for a year, and the year starts, as I said, I got to attend to a little bit of business because of that litigious twerp who's got, what are we up to now? $20 million worth of suits? That's good. Don't worry, I'll see it off. I'm a bang and not a whimper guy when it comes to seeing these things off. So don't worry about that. And we will be back once I've attended to this and that. And we will be here with our cruise in September. Come on the cruise. We'll be doing the Mark Stein Show live. Might do a Clubland Q&A live. We'll be doing Tales for Our Time live. We'll be doing some of our Sunday poems live, special guests, all the rest of it. There's Fall Foliage. We'll be going to Quebec City, where a continent changed hands, the Plains of Abraham, Wolfe and Montcalm. We'll be going to Prince Edward Island, Anne of Green Gables. Where do you find a woman like that these days? We'll be going, where else? Oh, yeah, Halifax, Nova Scotia, where the dead from the Titanic were taken. Sydney, Nova Scotia, beautiful. Who doesn't love that Cape Breton fiddling? Everyone in the control room is fleeing in terror. And we'll be going to Bar Harbor, Maine. We won't be stopping at Kennebunkport. Laura Bush apparently feels we're a bit like rough riffraff types and want us in there. We're going to Bar Harbor, Maine, then down to Boston. So come along and join us. That is all on the inaugural Mark Stein Club Cruise. And you can figure out how to sign up for that. If you go to steinonline.com, the clue is there's a picture with a big boat in it, and you just click on that and it'll bring you to the right page. And that is it for this edition of Clubland Q&A. We had a ton of great questions, some of which are timeless and we will address in a future video edition of Mark's Mailbox, including the one from Toby Pilling, who wants Brexit to be renamed Brino, Brexit in name only, which is what it's turning into. So we will come on the cruise and we will talk Brino on the Briny in September. But for now, that is it from this edition of Clubland Q&A.